Introduce our colloquium speaker, Sir Roger Penrose. So I'm sure he's well known to all of you, but I'm going to make a few introductory comments regardless. So Roger is the Emeritus Rouse Ball Professor of Mathematics at the University of Oxford. He's well known for having very wide-ranging interests in mathematics and physics, in particular in general relativity, cosmology, and quantum gravity. So for people at Perimeter, we'll be familiar with his results such as singularity theorems, cosmic censorship hypotheses, Penrose diagrams. And in the foundations of quantum mechanics, he's well known for proposing gravitationally induced collapse theories. And of course, in geometry, he's known for Penrose tilings, which are non-periodic tilings of the plane with five-fold symmetry that have since been discovered to arise in nature. Roger also has a long list of awards, including the Wolf Prize and the Dirac Medal. And he's also written many books, popular works on mathematics and physics. And so in particular, his first book, The Emperor's New Mind, holds a special place in my heart because it's the first place I ever read about Bell's theorem. And a fantastic book as well. And you might be familiar with one of his more recent books. It's a monumental book of 1,100 pages called The Road to Reality. And what's really striking for me about that book is just the audacity of the project to try to take a lay audience from zero to advanced topics in modern physics. So I recommend that one to you as well. Roger's a longtime friend of Perimeter. He was on the original Scientific Advisory Committee, and he, in fact, gave the very first PI public lecture almost 20 years ago. Anyhow, so we're very pleased that he graciously accepted to come back and visit us this week and to tell us a little bit about his recent thoughts on cosmology. Roger.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure for me to be back here at the Perimeter Institute. I was here when it was not so big, and the big, I'm not sure which direction I should be pointing. The big addition wasn't there. I was here when it was in a church, wasn't here at all. So I'm not sure if that's a logical contradiction, but never mind. Anyway, I want to talk about something about, well, it involves a cosmological model, which I suppose is getting on for 15 years old. I wrote a book called Cycles of Time, which describes the model. And it used to be the case that I would give lectures on this and feel that I could keep on giving lectures on this forever because nobody ever would discover that it was right or wrong. But in the meantime, certain ideas have come which seem to be tests of this. And I want to talk specifically about a new one, which is only less than a year old. I and mainly Christoph Meisner and Daniel Ann have been exploring this, and Pavel Nerovsky. Now, this picture I have here is a space-time picture of pretty well as the universe as we seem to see it. Here's the Big Bang. It expands out, and we seem to start seeing this exponent. We're somewhere around here. I'm not quite why, where. The exponential expansion of the universe, which I consider to be a reflection of the presence of a positive cosmological constant. It's often called dark energy to allow for it to be something else. But to me, Einstein's introduction of this term in 1917, although he considered it to be his greatest blunder, was actually correct. And that's the way I'm going to view it, that there is a cosmological constant responsible for this exponential expansion, which will continue indefinitely. Now, people might look at this picture and say there's something missing of great importance, namely inflation. Now, there are two reasons why I haven't put it in there. The simplest one to say is that I don't actually believe in it. And I want to say some more about that, why I'm allowed not to believe in it. It has to do with the rest of what I want to say. But the other reason that I haven't shown it in the picture is that maybe I have shown it in the picture. Namely, it would have been tucked right up in this little black spot at the beginning here. So in order to get a better view of that black spot, let me take out a very powerful magnifying glass and have a look at it. So what do we actually see with this magnifying glass? where we see something like this. I should say that's the handle of a magnifying glass, so don't get into any arguments about what that is, part of the universe. But what you see, apparently, according to inflation, is this exponential expansion. Big bang down here, and then for many, many things called e-folds, this is supposed to expand and expand and expand. And I like to compare this with what we see now, the exponential expansion. In fact, this comparison is often made, but you have a completely different scale at which these two things happen. Now, I'm going to take the view that inflation didn't happen, and I have to argue something about what replaces inflation. But before doing that, let me comment on one of the reasons that people take inflation seriously. When I first heard about it, I thought, oh, that's not going to last a week. I was completely wrong. But many people tend to say, well, there might have been irregularities, and you need inflation to iron out the irregularities and stretch things out so that everything gets nice and smooth. I consider that to be a wrong argument, because for reasons like this, let's imagine that we have a collapsing universe instead. If this is the solution of the Einstein equations, then so also is this. They're time symmetric. So that is certainly the kind of thing we might expect to be the solution of Einstein's equations. But let's imagine there are certain irregularities taking place. It's not just this conventional isotropic and homogeneous model that we tend to talk about in cosmology. Let's suppose there are little irregularities. And as the universe collapses, these irregularities will increase and increase until you get an incredible mess at the end like this. So that is the sort of generic collapse to a great mess of a singularity. It's the sort of thing one expects to happen inside black holes, but it would also be expected for a collapsing universe in which you introduce irregularities and they're not sort of correlated in some incredible way, and you'd expect to find a great mess like that. Now, if that's the solution of the Einstein's equations, then so is that. I should say also, you could put the inflaton field in also, and it wouldn't make any difference to that picture. The inflaton field would not affect the collapse and the crazy stuff that happens at the end. So why is that not the possible solution of the universe, inflaton field or not? It certainly could be. And you can also estimate the probability, if it was a sort of random choice, how unlikely is this compared with this? And you come up with figures like 1 in 10 to the power, 10 to the power, 124. So something like that. 1 followed by 10 to the power, 124 zeros, which is an awful lot of zeros. So why was it like this and not like this? This is the sort of thing I've worried about for a long time. Inflation is not the way to get rid of the problem of those most likely universes being like that. I'll come back to that issue shortly. It's an important part of what I want to have to say. But before going to the details of that, let me talk about a nice way of thinking about this model of the universe, which makes it all, you can put it on a postcard rather than having to have an infinite piece of paper or something. Namely, we take, this is the same picture before, but just drawn smaller, and we now do two things. One is put in a conformal factor, which squashes down infinity to make it something nice and smooth. I should give you this picture, which is one of many famous Escher pictures. This is a picture of hyperbolic geometry. Don't worry about that particular geometry, but it's a very realistic illustration of that geometry. We have to imagine these fish, or whatever they are exactly, as far as they're concerned, they're exactly the same all over, but it's just they're conformally squashed, that is the squashing, which is the same amount in all directions. So if you look at the eyes of the fish, for instance, then they remain circular no matter how close to the boundary you find. And this transformation is a conformal way of representing the entire infinite hyperbolic plane in a finite region. And the boundary is this nice, smooth boundary. Now, we're going to use a trick very much like that, but applying that to the universe as a whole and squashing down the infinity to something finite. So that's what this picture. Oh, I should say one thing about these pictures, which you might find a little puzzling. I've drawn them as though there's some kind of frilly bit at the back, which is kind of vague. The reason for doing it like that is just that I don't want to prejudice the issue as to whether the universe is actually open or closed. It's much easier to draw it as though it were closed, but I don't want to say, spatially closed, that is, But I don't want to say it is, so I'm allowing it to keep on going at the back. Maybe it closes up, maybe it doesn't. That doesn't have any particular role to play in what I say at all. That's just to allow for that possibility. I'll put the wiggles at the back, but don't worry about them. Okay, now what about the Big Bang? Now here I've stretched it out. And with the standard cosmological models, you can certainly do that. That's known for a long time. You can stretch it out. In the other way, you have a conformal factor which stretches rather than squashes and makes you have a nice conformal boundary. Okay, I haven't done anything very exciting at this point, but I do want to say something a little more unusual, which is that this is the model which I talk about often. It's what I call conformal cyclic cosmology, which is to say that the Big Bang was the conformal extension of the conformally completed an eon or something. You see, this is us, this is our eon, you can call it our universe. I prefer to call it our eon, that is part of the entire, the universe consists of all these things together, one after the other. I can't consider them as separate because influences can come through from one to the next, and that's an important part of what I want to say. So this is the model. And that model is, like I say, not conventional, but it does do some things which I want to try and tell you about. So, but before we're doing that, this is not an unconventional thing to do. However, it does bring together certain aspects of things. Let me, first of all, say something more about conformal transformations or conformal maps or conformal pictures in a Lorentzian case. So we don't have a space which is locally Euclidean like we have here, but we have Lorentzian space-time, and Lorentzian space-time is characterized by the existence of light cones. So we have here we have light cones, and we have at each point, of course, a light cone, and we may consider that we want to consider more than the light cone. The light cone contains, roughly speaking, 9 out of the 10 components of the metric, or more correctly, you have a 10-component metric. That is 10 numbers that characterize the metric at one point. But the 9 independent ratios of that are what give you the light cone, or the light cone gives you that. That's the conformal structure. The conformal structure is the light cones. Now, the addition to that is the scaling, which I've indicated here. I have a couple of clocks going by, and this is the first tick of the clocks, the second and third, and you see that this is the Lorentzian time. And you have to add these surfaces in order to give you a picture of the full metric, not just the conformal metric. An important point I want to make here is that clocks are very fundamental to general relativity, basically because of the two most famous equations of 20th century physics. First of them has, one of them has to be Einstein's E equals mc squared, of course. The other one is Planck's E equals h nu, and E and c are constants. So the first, or I should say, Einstein tells you that energy and mass are equivalent, and Planck tells us that energy and frequency are equivalent, so therefore mass and frequency are equivalent. That's a very simple statement, and here that means if we have a stable particle, here it is a clock. And it's a very, very perfect clock for the reason of these two fundamental equations. And it's the existence of these clocks which give you the scale, which gives us the metric as opposed to having simply the conformal structure. Now I'll illustrate that a little bit more broadly using a picture here. This is, I imagine, the light cones here, so that's the conformal structure of the space-time indicated that way. Here I have a black hole, so you can see in particular how the light cones tilt over and prevent information from getting up. Information is supposed to travel along light rays or along time-like curves. World lines of particles within the cones, light rays along the cones. So that's the picture we have. If you have the full metric, that picture is not complete. You would want to introduce the scale. So I want you to compare these two pictures. One is the metric of Einstein's theory, the other is the conformal structure. And a particular point I want to make is that if we had, so I said this one way around, if we have massive, stable massive particles, we have clocks. But if we don't have them, if we have only massless things around, well, you think of a photon zipping along here, it just zips along the cone, doesn't even see these surfaces. Or more strongly, if you think of Maxwell's equations, which describe the electromagnetic field, then of course, they have this wonderful property that they are scale invariant. You can change the scale at any point independently as you go around, and the Maxwell equations, if you write them in the right way, still are correct. They don't get affected. So they don't need these things. Maxwell's equations just interested in that. And that's still true if you're looking at the classical Yang-Mills equations, considering the equations of that describe particles and their interactions. When you're talking about the Yang-Mills equations and its classical equations, the Yang-Mills equations are, again, conformally invariant, more or less the same reason as Maxwell's are. So this picture is very good for all that, but of course some of physics does involve mass, and one of the important things which involves mass, of course, is general relativity, and so one has to take the mass into consideration there. Okay, let me go back to my picture a minute ago about these two ways of squashing infinity and stretching out the Big Bang. Now, I wanted to say there are two different things. There's something very different about the two. One of them is, if we think about the future, there are theorems, most particularly a theorem due to Helmut Friedrich, which tells you that if you have massless sources here and you can perturb away as you like, as long as you don't sort of introduce a gravitational collapse somewhere, that the generic situation is that you can indeed do this top part. You can squash infinity down. That's completely generic. You can have all sorts of things, irregularities going on, and this still works. The other one, the Big Bang, is completely the opposite. This is a very, very special thing, and that's something that I claim is something you want to do. Roughly speaking, for the reason that I told you that you could have all these different other Big Bangs, great messes and things like that, inflation doesn't get rid of them, but what could get rid of them is a hypothesis. I used to say the Weyl curvature hypothesis, which says you make the Weyl curvature go to zero, but that's a little bit awkward. The conformal curvature go to zero. That's a bit awkward because it's hard to say what that means, what you mean by taking a limit, and so on, and it's a little bit awkward. So my colleague, Paul Todd, former student of mine, had a better way of saying it, which is simply this, that if you can stretch it out to form something smooth, that is a wonderful criterion, which is much easier to say and to use than to say that the Weyl curvature, the conformal curvature, goes to zero. So this is his condition, to say that the condition on the Big Bang is like that. And sort of that is a reason why it's a good idea to have this picture of mine, because it sort of tells you that the conformal continuation of our Big Bang, that Paul Todd would say is a correct characterization we like to impose on the model, that is not into who cares what. You just say, see, the idea was it's a mathematical characterization. You don't say what's going on behind there. You just say the condition on the Big Bang is that you can locally extend this hypersurface at the beginning to something before. It doesn't say it has any existence. It's just a mathematical trick. What I'm saying now is maybe that mathematical trick actually, I'm getting confused here, actually has a meaning, and that what was before it, there was a before, and that before was the expansion of the previous eon. You might also worry about, okay, maybe conformally it looks similar, but surely the temperature is ridiculously small here and ridiculously large there. You might say the density is ridiculously large here and ridiculously small there. But the thing is, when you do the conformal squashing, the mass goes oppositely to the time and the momentum to the distance. And hot becomes, when you squash cold, it becomes hot. When you stretch hot, it becomes cold. And likewise, the density, of course, goes up when you squash and down when you stretch. And so it looks as though it fits pretty well. And just at first sight, when you look at the general parameters and things, forget about inflation for the moment, then it does seem to fit. But then what, let's remember about inflation now. So what's my view? See, my view is inflation, okay, there was a sort of inflation, but it was not after the Big Bang. It was this exponential expansion of the eon that preceded ours. Okay, in fact, that idea, I guess, originated with Veneziano and what was his name? Gasparini, I've got his name now. Veneziano had a model in which you had the exponential expansion taking place before the Big Bang. I think it's a very good picture. I never liked pushing things into this 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. It didn't seem natural. I didn't see how you could turn off inflation all over the place all at once. And it was a great problem as far as I was concerned. Ah, I've suddenly found the initial. This is. I can see my things have got out of order, and somehow this was supposed to be my initial slide. Sorry about that. It's not actually. This was I gave a lecture called Hawking Points. I used to call them. I'm calling them Hawking Spots this time. I'm not sure that's not such a nice name, but they are really spots. What we see, the points are there, but we don't see the points. I'll come back to that shortly. But that's the. I just revived that picture. Sorry, I didn't find it before. Never mind. It's not too important. Okay. So inflation, if it's anything, it's this exponential expansion prior to the Big Bang. And I'm not using it to smooth the universe out. I consider it doesn't smooth the universe out. But it may well do the other things which inflation is good for. So inflation does good things and it does bad things. So I say when it does bad things, it doesn't do other good things. What it doesn't do is necessarily smooth the universe out. What it does do is, in a way, but I'm never happy with that either, is give you the scale invariance of the temperature fluctuations you see in the cosmic microwave background. So if you don't have that, you've got to have something in this previous eon doing the same thing. Whether I'll get to that in my talk, I'm not sure, because there are other things I want to say, and it's always quite a bit. It keeps growing how much I should be saying, so let's see. Okay, what about the remote future? Well, the remote future thins out and thins out, but what is the last thing to go will be these supermassive black holes. So we have in our galaxy, for example, a 4 million, roughly speaking, supermassive black hole, and that black hole will be around for a long time. Well, it's probably get swallowed up by Andromeda's black hole when we collide with it, so that will be in a few thousand million years, and it's, I don't know how much bigger than ours it is, maybe 40 times or more, I can't remember. But they will, when they come together, they will eventually spiral in towards each other and there will be some walloping explosion. I'll come back to that later. But the point is you'll end up in a cluster of galaxies probably with one dominant supermassive black hole, super-duper massive black hole, which has swallowed up probably, I would guess, the majority of the material in the galactic cluster. It's pretty hard to escape from a cluster, so I think that's probably, it would swallow most of the material. I could stand corrected if need be to that. It's not essential for what I want to say, but it makes it easier to say what I want to say. Okay, so here's the black hole, evaporating. It doesn't start until the universe's temperature gets down to less than that of the black hole, of course, which is ridiculously small temperature, and that temperature will be higher than that of the ambient temperature of the environment in the universe, but after the exponential expansion and so on, it will get to be the hottest thing around and then it will evaporate away. Well, the whole thing will take, say, maybe 10 to the 100 years or maybe more for really, really big ones. And then it will end with this thing I call a pop. It's a pop, okay, the very last thing that goes off will probably be about a Planck mass explosion, which would be something like a sizable artillery shell. But then just before that, there will be lots of radiation coming out too. So there's a lot coming out, but then this radiation is photons, and photons don't have any mass, and so they're just consistent with this picture. You might worry about massive particles. Well, what about electrons? But there will be some rogue electrons running around, and rogue positrons or protons, whatever they are, running around too, and some of them will meet up with each other and make something neutral and maybe what? Well, the thing is that the electrons have to have mass, they're charged, and so the positrons which they might collide with, they won't be able to find them usually because they get outside each other's horizons and there will be charged particles running around towards the end. So I have an additional hypothesis, which some people say is the weakest point of the theory. If it's the weakest, I'm not too worried about it, because there might be other things to complain about. But the hypothesis I make is that there is a gradual fade out of mass, which takes, it's not I'm saying that it decays, I'm just saying that the mass itself, because we have a different way of looking at particle physics, which has a cosmological constant in it, and we have different Casimir operators and things like that, and you have to look carefully to see what happens to mass in a very, very long time scale. And I'm claiming, for this picture to make proper sense, that mass will ultimately fade out, and so that you don't have any obstruction to the conformal picture in the very remote future. You might ask about the Big Bang, of course. What happens to that? Well, it's the other way around. Now you see what happens to mass there. Well, now the temperatures get hotter and hotter and hotter as you get closer to the Big Bang. And as they get hotter and hotter, you get to the point where the temperature of the individual particles isn't almost entirely in their kinetic motion and not in the mass, and so they might as well can be considered as massless. Or if you go back before the Higgs era or something like that, and you can raise questions about the Higgs mechanism and how that affects both ends. But certainly the normal picture would be that things behave massless right at the beginning, and that was Paul Todd's idea, that one can consider it as all massless, and that gives you this picture to make sense. So that's not unconventional, I say. This is the thing which is you have to think more seriously about. Okay. In fact, what about the business of the Big Bang? Why wasn't it one of these complicated messes? This is the second law of thermodynamics that we need to worry about, and it's something which I worried about for many decades. And you can think about it in a cosmological context, and you can think, okay, the entropy in the universe is going up, that's the second law. Another way of saying more or less the same thing is if you go back in time, the universe is coming down. I mean, the entropy is coming down and down and down. So it's going down and down and down and down. And what is the earliest thing we can directly see? The earliest thing we can directly see is the cosmic microwave background. Not quite the Big Bang, 380,000 years after the Big Bang, but okay, you're getting fairly close. And what do you see? Well, you see, one of the most obvious things you see is the Planck spectrum. This is to say, and this is the frequency this way of the radiation and the intensity that way, and we see this curve. The error bars are the Planck curve compared with the observed figures that Kobe measured, and they're magnified by a factor of 500. So even at the worst place down here, they hug the incline to within the thickness of the incline. So it's extremely good Planck curve that you see. What's that telling you? Well, it's telling you the entropy is at a maximum. It's what I call the mammoth in the room. You go back and back and back in time, and the entropy is going down and down until it reaches the maximum. Yeah, there's something a bit odd about that, you might think. Indeed, there is, because it should be some sort of minimum, shouldn't it? Well, you see, it's not a paradox. It's just an interesting fact. It's not a paradox because what we're looking at here is matter and radiation in maximum state of entropy. And that gives you this curve. Now, there's other things to think about there, not just matter and radiation, but gravity. And that is the central factor that one has to consider. And the other thing which is most obvious about CMB is not just this curve, but it's very uniform over the sky. If you correct for the Earth's motion through the radiation, you find that these temperature variations are something like one part in 100,000, and so they're pretty uniform. And so they're uniform sky, and why is it uniform? Well, if you consider what it might have been like, and you consider gravity. This is a picture. I've done these things many times in talks, so there's nothing new here. The new stuff I will come to shortly, but let me tell you the old stuff first. If you have a gas in a box, and let's imagine it's constrained to one corner, and then you remove the boundaries to the box, a little compartment here, remove the boundaries to the compartment, it spreads out over the box, and the entropy is going up, so uniform distribution represents high entropy. But what about gravity? Well, uniform distribution represents low entropy. The universally attractive nature of the, say, imagine there's a lot of stars running around in a galaxy or something like that. There's a tendency to concentrate in lumps and finally to black holes where the entropy goes shooting up. So this is both consistent with the second law, this way and this way, But the picture is very different. What we see is a combination of this and this. That's what you see. As far as matter and radiation is concerned, it's this. As far as gravity is concerned, it's this. And what you're seeing is that the taking up of the low reservoir of entropy in the uniformity in the gravitational field by material clumping, producing stars and galaxies and things, and finally black holes. And that's what we live off, so that's fine. And I sometimes get a picture like this, showing us living off the entropy. Sun is a hot spot in a dark sky. Being a hot spot, the radiation coming from it is mainly in yellow light photons, which are much more energetic than the infrared photons, which get away at night. And so you have the same energy coming in as goes out, more or less, apart from global warming, of course. Same energy coming in as going out. But the thing is, you know, it's spread out over far fewer degrees of freedom when it comes in, and far more as it goes out. And that's a point made by Schrödinger a long time ago, that what you really get from the sun is a source of low entropy. The energy in a source of low entropy, the energy itself goes back out again. You don't get that energy. You throw it back in a form which you don't like so much. In other words, high entropy material. Okay, so all that seems to hang together. What about the following? Here we have a picture, and I say it's what I'm driven to by the second law of thermodynamics, but doesn't say the second law of thermodynamics say that something is increasing with time, so the entropy should be increasing, 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 increasing. Then how do I have a cyclic model in which the entropy is not increasing all the time? Well, here's where I get into trouble with certain people. Let me explain which they are. Sometimes they're both of them. The same person is on both sides. Let me tell you who that person is. Stephen Hawking told us initially, I should warn you, my macular degeneration prevents me from reading my slide here. I hope I've got the right one up there. I wouldn't guarantee it. But I think it's the one which somewhere in the middle tells us that Hawking, in his initial discussion of the evaporation of black holes and the radiation going away, taking energy away and so on, that information is lost in the black hole. Later on, he changed his mind. That's Hawking 2 now. He changed his mind, and he considered that somehow the information had to get back again. Now, I never liked the second point of view. I think he was right the first time, and that's the view I'm taking. And if people want to argue with me about that, I'm quite happy to argue about it. It seems to me that information is lost. If you look at conformal diagrams and that sort of thing, you see how on earth can that thing which is getting near a singularity, information work its way right out to the outside without violating the principle of what it's called, the no cloning theorem in quantum mechanics, which says you can't copy the information somewhere else. So it's not copied somewhere else, it just goes down the drain in the black hole. So that's my view. And how does that work? Well, you see, the black holes dominate in how much entropy there is in the universe, even now. Now, by an absolutely enormous figure, the entropy in our universe is in black holes, almost entirely. Trivial little additions are what we talk about in physics experiments and so on. But if you take the whole thing as a whole, it's almost entirely in black holes. What happens to the black holes? Well, as I said, they evaporate away. And as they evaporate away, they swallow degrees of freedom. Now, the thing is, you see, when you want to talk about the entropy, what do you mean? Well, if that black hole's gone, you want to maybe have a phase space or something, and you put in all the degrees of freedom to describe your phase space. But do you put in those degrees of freedom which have got swallowed by the black hole? Not much point, because they're not doing anything anymore. They're gone. So you factor down your phase space to a smaller phase space, and that smaller phase space has an effectively smaller entropy, simply because you've lost lots of degrees of freedom and your volumes have collapsed down in those dimensions, which correspond to the degrees of freedom that have got swallowed. So as long as they really are swallowed, that means that a good proportion of the entropy in that black hole simply must be crossed off. And the phase space volume has come whopping down, and your entropy has come down. They've gone one pop, 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 whatever they do, all over the place. And until they're all gone, when they're all gone, 10 to 100 years or whatever it is, then all those degrees of freedom, the entropy that you
calculated using those degrees of freedom, now those have all gone, your entropy has come right down to a value which is, you wait now till the crossover to the next eon, and you find that the entropy has now started off at this very low value. As far as I can make out, this point of view is quite consistent, perfectly consistent. It's not quite the normal view where you don't like to change your mind about what you mean by entropy. There's no violation of the second law. It's just that what you mean by entropy, when the black holes disappear, or when you choose to say that they're not much use to you anymore, whatever point you say, I'm not going to count those black holes entropy anymore, then the value that you say use for your entropy of the universe is lower, and that's how you get away with being consistent with the second law. So I think that works. That worried me for quite a long time. But as far as I can see, that's a consistent view. Now, what about observations? Now, as I say, for a long time, I thought I'd be happy to give talks like this till the end of time, or till the end of the eon, or whatever it is, and nobody would ever know whether it was right or wrong. But certain ideas came to me later on, which seemed to me you might get information through from one eon to the next. And usually I would concentrate on the following thing. It's not going to be what my talk's about here, but it is something which I did talk about quite a bit. And I think the evidence is pretty strong, actually. But let's go back to the picture. What is it? I talked about our black hole eventually coming a cropper by being swallowed up by the Andromeda mass, the Andromeda black hole, and all the ones in our galactic cluster will, well, we've only got about three or four, I can't remember how many, but they're a lot bigger ones. You've got huge clusters, not superclusters, but huge clusters with many, many galaxies in them, and after a long, well, not a long time compared with eternity, but a long time, these things will start running into each other, and each time they do, so I've got a picture here, this is the crossover surface between the previous eon here and the succeeding eon here. I'm supposing we're in the succeeding eon, but this is us sitting up here looking back. This is the previous eon, and in the previous eon, there were some supermassive black holes in a cluster here, swallowing each other up until it ended up with one of them. And each time they run into each other, there will be a huge explosion in the form of gravitational radiation, which comes out and hits the crossover surface. But what happens when it hits the crossover surface? That requires a bit of detailed considerations, which I'll come to in a moment. But the answer, I claim, is that this does not come through in the form of gravitational radiation, because the gravitational radiation... Let me say something about this transition, which I didn't mention before. Maybe I should. You see, Paul Todd's consideration was that the Big Bang had to be, that was the hypothesis, had to be such that you could conformally extend it to something before. Now, if you make that hypothesis, that demands that the viral curvature, the conformal curvature, remains finite at the boundary. It doesn't tell you it's zero at the boundary, it's finite. And that actually was his version of the viral curvature hypothesis. It's a strong condition, but it's not as strong as saying it's zero. So he said it remains finite. And that allows you to have this join. But then when you start looking at the equations about what happens in the remote future, and you find that the way things scale, whether I have time to say anything about that, I'm not sure, that the way things scale, you find that in order for the gravitational radiation, it remains, as in this other picture, let me bring that other picture down again, in this picture I had here, as this gravitational radiation meets the boundary, you have a way of measuring it which tells you the intensity of that at the boundary. It's a curious feature of conformal transformations, which had puzzled me for decades, which you have two different conformal factors coming into gravitational theory. One of them has to do with the viral curvature, the conformal curvature. If it's conformal curvature, it's a conformal thing, and therefore it behaves perfectly well defined. The other thing is thinking of gravitational radiation as being one of just similar things where you have electromagnetic radiation, you have, if neutrinos were massless, spin half radiation, massless fields, and they have a certain way of scaling to preserve the propagation equation. And that way of scaling makes them finite on the boundary. This was extremely useful to me in my younger days when I was talking about radiation and how you measure it, and you look at what we call scry, that is the conformal boundary of the space-time, and that conformal boundary, the scaling which makes the Maxwell field finite and this gravitational thing finite, gives you a finite measure at infinity, which tells you how strong the radiation field is. And that's a very useful way of talking about it. But the scale factor, which preserves that propagation, is different from the scale factor which the conformal curvature gives you. So you've got, it's a curious thing in gravity theory. You've got two different ways in which conformal symmetry acts, and it's different. One of them is the way you might say a graviton, that's the radiation of the gravitational field behaves, and that gives you a finite value at infinity. The other is the way that the conformal curvature behaves, and that gives you a zero value at infinity. So going back to this question of, was Paul's picture of a finite via curvature at the boundary the right picture, or should we... excuse me for all this, I'm sorry, I can't see what I'm doing. What you find is that the radiation, gravitational radiation here, remains, that way of scaling gives you finite, and therefore the vial curvature is zero. So it's not simply that the vial curvature is finite at the crossover, it's actually zero. So in the form that the original vial curvature hypothesis that I put forward holds, yes indeed, in this picture, the vial curvature is actually zero at crossover. Okay, well then what happens here? You've got radiation coming out, and it hits the boundary. Well, you look at the form where its vial curvature has gone to zero, but then the other component, the other way of looking at it, namely the where it scales as massless field scale, you find that it's the normal derivative of it, which is still non-zero, and that tells you the intensity of the gravitational field. Then you have to look at the equations, and if I have time to look at them, I will, but you look at the equations and see what that tells you. Okay, the vial curvature is zero. The normal derivative translates into the normal derivative in a material which is created at crossover. I see I'm talking about my things in an order which I hadn't quite intended to. So let me come back to that, if I have time, later on, and tell you what the other thing which I'm talking about. I'm just saying here that this is a signal. What it does is it pushes... As the signal, the gravitational wave comes back, comes along, it gives a kick to the initial dark matter, and that dark matter pulls the other material, the plasma, behind it for its gravitational effect. And if it's coming towards you, it looks blue shifted. It's the wrong way from which you normally think. Coming towards you from distant source, it's blue shifted, it's hotter. When it's a close source, what you see is it red shifted as it's going away from you. So you see red shifted going away from you, blue shifted as it's coming towards you, and the distant sources are the ones which it's blue shifted. So get used to that. But what do you see? Well, according to this idea, what you would see is the intersection of this past cone with these future cones, and just think about it a bit. What do you see? A circle. And that circle, I'm drawing it here, here's the collision point. If you could see the central point right through, you could see where the galaxy black hole was, if you can see right through, but you can't. You can only see the CMB thing, and what you see is this ring of temperature, which is either a little raised or a little cooled. Or it has, if neither, if you see it on the edge, it's slightly less variation in temperature than other places. I'm not sure I want to talk about that, but that's, I might. Okay. So these are these two ways that you might see something from the Big Bang, from before the Big Bang. You might see the black hole encounters, gravitational radiation, and this gives you rings. I should you, what are these two surfaces? The earlier one is the Big Bang itself. The later one is the scatter of surface of last scattering. That's 380,000 years after that. So between this and this, you have a bit of spread out from here to here. But you still get these rings. And the claim is that these rings are there. It's controversial. Some people say, oh no, they're just random. But I think a pretty convincing case was made by my Polish colleagues. This is Christoph Meissner. Christoph Meissner and Daniel An, who did the analysis, and Pavel Nirovsky, two Poles and a Korean who works in New York. That's Daniel An. And they analyzed the data very thoroughly and finally got a paper accepted by the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society with a confidence level of 99.4% confidence that this was a real effect. They had all sorts of problems with referees. Referees had kept saying, no, no, you should do this, you should do this. They did everything. And finally, the editor wrote back and said, well, I'm terribly sorry, we're going to have to accept your paper. Something like that. Didn't say quite that, but what they said more or less was, we'll accept your paper on condition that you say this may be a chance effect. That's what they did, but the chance was also given. Namely, the chance that it's a real effect is 124 to 1. Okay, so they didn't spell it out quite like that, but that's what the paper says. Now, that's not the main thing I want to talk about. This is what I want to talk about, is what happens to those black holes. Now, you see, I knew there were going to be a problem, because the black holes take an incredible length of time before they decide to disappear eventually. And this length of time, you see, I've drawn it in this picture, is not all that long, but of course, if it's 10 to 100 years, that's an awful long time. And how long is it as a in the conformal picture? It's right, you wouldn't see it. It's just underneath this line. It's almost at the crossover surface. And what happens to that radiation? Well, it's very, very weak radiation, you know. It's just, you would try to mention that it's ridiculously low temperature, especially for these huge black holes. Ridiculously tiny, so forget it. Well, you can't forget it, because it's going on for 10 to the 100 years before the thing disappears. Where is 10 to the 100 years in the conformal picture? Well, I'll go back to this picture if you like. It's not quite the right picture, but it's very much like that. You must imagine that you're with these fish or something right near the boundary, where everything is just squashed down in the edge. So the light cone of that thing is just squashed into the edge. Everything is at one point. That's what I'm calling a Hawking point. A Hawking point in this theory would be the end point of the evaporation of a black hole, which is virtually at crossover. Now, what happens at the other side? Well, the entire rest mass, or the entire mass of that black hole, has been converted into this radiation, which is focused into this tiny little point. Also, as my colleague Christoph Meisner keeps telling me, a good proportion of that radiation is probably in neutrinos, too. So you will have an event here at the crossover where spewed out will be all that radiation, an enormous amount of mass, a huge explosion at this point. And it will be mainly photons. Neutrinos is an interesting question. I don't particularly, if people want to raise questions about that, it's conceivable there might be signals to do with the neutrinos. But that's more arguable. Definitely what you should see is the photons. So here's, I don't know if I've got the picture here. Yes, these are two of these Hawking points. The Hawking point is on the red surface. That's the Big Bang itself. The surface of last scattering is the blue surface, which is where the Hawking point explosion has got to. So it spreads out. Now, this is the sort of thing people do in their calculations of all these fancy curves that people draw for looking at the cosmic macro background and analyze it with multipoles and all that stuff. So what you do is you see what happens to a point event here and see how it spreads. So people know how to do this. That's all in the literature. But it spreads out. It spreads out to a region. How big is it? Well, you see, it's something like about 4 degrees across. How big is 4 degrees? Well, the moon is half a degree. So if you imagine the spot in the sky, it would be a spot which is 8 times the diameter of the moon. Maybe a bit less, because you have to think about our past light cone. I don't think I've got a picture doing that. But our past light cone, as it comes back and hits it, it won't necessarily hit it at the maximum. You may clip the edge of it or so. But you have to think in terms of something like maybe 5, 6, 7 times or 8 times the diameter of the moon. As a spot, that's why I'm calling it a Hawking spot, a spot in the sky. Now, you see, I'd thought about this for a while, but I couldn't face up to it, because I like to think of a nice, smooth transition from one eon to the next, and all my equations were concerned with that sort of thing. And I didn't sort of shy away from the idea of the Hawking thing, because that's, oh, what do I do with that? But then Christoph Meissner and his colleagues, they'd been looking for things as a result of conversations I'd had with Christoph previously about, yes, I should say this is the microwave background, of course. Way around are we? That way, isn't it? Yeah, that way around, yes. And this is the, I'm showing this now because the conventional way of doing analysis is something you see in the sky real or is it just a random thing? Well, what they do is they say, let's make a fake sky. In fact, let's make 1,000 fake skies. And those fake skies, you take this power spectrum, which is very well established, and let's take that. We don't randomize completely. We randomize, but only within the... You see, this is only one parameter. That's the L value here. And as L increases, the number of M value parameters goes as the square of L. So as L gets bigger and bigger and bigger, there's more and more information which you're allowed to play with. And in your normal analysis, you're allowed to randomize within all that. And then you've got thousands and thousands of fake skies, which you can compare with the real sky. And then you say, well, let's look at this effect in the fake skies. Do we see the effect that we would see from a possible Hawking point or not? Well, this is the data that I got from Christoph, that I got from Daniel Ann. I'll have to explain this picture a bit because he was looking at different sizes. Perhaps I should give you this picture first. I think it's better to do. What he was looking at were rings like this. It came, I should say, because initially they were looking for the other kind of ring. But the signal is sort of the other way around for the Hawking points. But the other kind of ring, you'd expect it to be hotter at the outer edge and getting cooler as you go in, because it's you're looking at a burst of radiation, and that drags the dark matter behind it, and it gives you a sharp edge and then a tail at the back. But what they were seeing was the opposite, something which seemed to be a heap in the middle, that is to say, raised temperature in the middle and tailing off towards the edge. And so they were looking for rings, and they were looking for the temperature gradient across a ring. For different variances, the inner radius, that was given by R1, and the different value for the outer radius, where going from the inner to the outer, is epsilon. So the width of the ring is epsilon, the inner radius is R1, I think was what they called it. And for different values of these things, they were trained to see rings. Initially, they were looking for the rings I was talking about before, but quite small ones, using this analysis. But what they found was a very striking effect, particularly at these two figures, where you're looking at these, I think, are radians, not degrees. I get very confused with these things. But let me compare that with the diagram here. Which way are we? That's the right way up. And what I'm going to do, you can look at this. You see, this is the R1, and this is the epsilon, and this is the epsilon with these R1s. And you have to, you see a mass of figures. What I want to point out to you is some particular feature of this mass of figures, and hoping I've got this one the right way up, which would be a critical thing, is that I've circled some of these figures. And Christoph said, this is very remarkable. What we see, 1,000 simulations. I'm looking at the green ones. Forget about the last two columns. I should say this is four different sizes of rings, sizes and shapes of rings. This one, but the R values are the same for both these. It's a bit confusing. The R values are the same for both these. And the epsilon values are these ones. Okay. But what they notice, as you look here, you get zero. It's not the last two columns. Zero. That meant there were no, in these 1,000 simulations, not a single one showed the features that you see in the real sky. And various people complained, oh, well, you were looking for something else first, as they call the look elsewhere effect, and since you were looking for something else, you concentrated on that. Well, okay, that's some point for that. Anyway, so Daniel went away, and he then did another 9,000 simulations. I got it right, yes, that's right. 10,000 he did altogether. And then that's the figures up here. Forget about these, that's for a different... I'll come back to that. But if you look at the blue-ringed ones, okay, you've got a 2 and a 1. So out of 10,000, you see on one case 1 and the other case 2. These are two different measurements, so you think of there's 20,000, 3 out of 20,000, that's about 99.98% confidence level. So you do seem to be seeing something. You seem to be seeing something which looks awfully like the Hawking point things. I've put another one in, which it's not so striking, but you can see there's something here too, because you've got numbers which are still pretty small compared with anything like 10,000. Or here, 1,000, here, 10,000. So even for those ones, you see a genuine signal. So what are you looking at? You're looking at rings which are this sort of size, and a temperature which is higher in the middle and goes lower as you go to, I should say, how much higher? About more than an order of magnitude higher than the 10 to the minus 5 fluctuations. In the normal fluctuations in the CMB, you see variations of the order of 1 in 10 to the 5. But here you see the temperature variation is more than 10 times greater than that. So these are real big spots. And they're big for another reason. Because in this picture, I put the moon. See? I said that this spreads out. See, if it was a single event, it would spread out to this from Big Bang to last scattering. So it spreads out to that much. And this is 8 times the diameter of the moon. So here's the moon. And you see these huge splodges out there. Now, nobody's seen them before. But they're there. Okay, I sent this information to my good friend and colleague from many years, many decades, Ted Newman. And he says, well, I'm no expert in cosmology, but I'll give it to my friend Arthur, let's call him. He is Arthur, who's his cosmologist friend. And the cosmologist said, well, look, you know, you can't trust these things. It might be this, it might be that, it might be the other thing. A clear test would be, look at the WMAP data. Because Planck, you know, they do funny things to the Planck data. They do photoshopping in different ways and so on. I don't know what they do to it, but it's not quite as clean and pristine as you might think. Okay, they have to rub the stars out, sure. You have to be careful not to make a little circle as you rub them out, of course, as that might create spurious effects. So there are little problems with that. So he said, look at the WMAP, see if you see the same thing there. So a few weeks ago, I got the message from Daniel Ann. Yep. They're in the WMAP data. Are they in the same places in the WMAP data? So he plots exactly the places. Well, you wouldn't expect all of them to be, because maybe you pick up some faint ones in one that you don't in the other. The 5 most prominent points are in exactly the same place in the Planck data as in the WMAP. That's pretty convincing. The 5 most prominent ones, the ones you trust the most, just from one set of observations with the other set, each of them find most 5 most prominent, and they're in exactly the same places. Again, there was some problem about, I don't know, and I don't understand these things, but there was something I heard from a colleague say, well, nobody will believe you unless you do blah, 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 which is some other way of doing the analysis, which was much more difficult, and poor old Daniel said he'd never seen this before, and who knows about this, and he was told there are only about 5 people in the world who understand it properly. I don't know, he eventually did it, he found it, and we got the message back. He said, whoopee, or hooray, or eureka, or something. They're there. So whatever, 3 different ways of looking for them, they're there. So we have these spots. That's what you see, is the Hawking spots. Now, could they be, what could have made them? Now, you see, maybe it was inflation or something. Well, if you believe in inflation, where could they be? Well, you've got a real problem, because these sizes, I should say, this is the, if you take a spot in the sky, this is the other Hawking point, which is a less, I mean, not another Hawking point, another size of ring examination, which is less prominent than the other 2, but nevertheless, it seems to be similar there. But that indicates if you have one point there, it spreads out to that much. So that's what you would see. Photons, that's where they would get. Neutrinos, another question, interesting. We need to think about that more. But 8 times the moon's diameter, or 7 times, maybe. Okay, how could that come about? You don't see them bigger. That's the point I want to make. You don't see them that big. You look carefully at these pictures of the data and you see they drop off dramatically. Anything bigger than that, you simply don't see here. So that means you don't see big things here. You see what would be, I mean, if it was bigger than a point, yeah, let's take this one. Here's the Big Bang there. Big Bang without inflation here. Here is the last scattering surface, spreads out to 7 or 8 degrees. But if it was a bigger initial thing, it would spread out more. The least spread, I mean, to get that much spread and no more, it's got to be a point, or not much bigger than a point. Where is that point? Well, it's at the crossover, in my scheme, crossover from one eon to the next. Sure, it should be a point, because that's the entire history of that black hole squashed down into that little tiny point. Yes, it should be a point, and that's clear. What about inflation? What does inflation do? It stretches things out. If it's anywhere except at the moment of turnoff of inflation, it would spread out to something much bigger. Okay, what's the moment of turnoff? What's the thing they call the graceful exit? Graceful, the graceful exit. Okay, I don't know. I'm expecting next week somebody will come up with an explanation from inflation which says, okay, we've discovered that you can have these violent explosions taking place at the moment of graceful exit. Okay, well, I'm waiting for that. But it seems to me the case is pretty strong. Can somebody tell me the time and where have I gone over time? How much, what's the duration?
Near the end.
Near the end, okay. Maybe I shouldn't say. Yeah, let me just make a comment, because there are other things about this scheme which should be observable and are necessary. You see, I should have slapped down a few pages of equations, you see. That's, if I've got a minute, you either do that, you see. Here, what you do is you have different metrics. See, here's one metric, that's the Einstein metric for before crossover, here is for after, and then you have a bandage metric we introduce in. A metric which is smooth across one, and then you have a conformal factor which turns into its inverse when you go to the other side. There's fairly clear rules about what you do. But as you follow these things through, what you find is that because the conformal factor turns into its inverse, I hope that's the right way around, turns into inverse, what used to be a conformal factor, that's capital omega, transforms itself into an actual field. And it needs to do that to be consistent. In sort of rough terms, I would say, the universe was all stretched out. To make it hold together, you need a whole lot of mass. That's just a hand-waving saying what the equations say. What the equations say is you need a new material which came initially from something which wasn't real, the conformal factor, and then the way the thing works is it becomes new material. And that is what we consider to be the initial form of dark matter. It's the dominant material in the universe. It's got to be there or the equations don't work. So you have a scalar field, probably it gains mass by some kinds of Higgs or whatever it is process. It gains mass. What mass does it gain? Or first of all, what does it do? It's basically, it carries the gravitational degrees of freedom over. You might worry, gravitational degrees of freedom, if vial curvature goes to zero, they get lost. They don't get lost. They translate into the fourth, well, I should be more explicit, they translate into two things. The normal derivative of the vial curvature is what translates over here. The two things, what are they? One of them is into the Cotton tensor, which is a conformal curvature to the crossover surface itself. So it's not exactly conformally flat. Each time these explosions happen, it gets little wrinkles. So that three-dimensional surface is not conformally flat. That's where some of the information goes. The rest, the other half, goes into the fourth derivative of the dark matter field. So the kick in the dark matter field, you can work these things out, and there would be a sort of shock wave in that dark matter field, which, as I said before, drags the material behind it, and that's what you see in the rings. But the other point about this is this dark matter, you don't want it to build up so that it's from one eon to the next, to the next, to the next. It's got a decay as you get from one to the next. And the decay is important. First of all, what is it? What's the mass? What does it do? Well, it only interacts gravitationally. It's only gravitation. That's all it is. And dark matter, that's what we know about dark matter. What else about it? Well, what do we know about the mass of dark matter? Pretty well nothing. It has a, I don't know what the range is, something from way more than less than neutrinos or something up to the mass of the sun. I don't know what the figure is. The claim here is all you've got to play with is gravity, something like a Planck mass. I asked my cosmological colleagues, how about that? Does that fit in? Sure, that's all right. It's way within the range. Planck mass is fine. Ask my particle physics, the heads drop through the roof or something. No, but sure, Planck mass. But when they decay, what do they decay into? Well, as my Polish colleague Ivo Bielinski-Berula says to me, what else can it be? It's got to be gravitons. There's nothing else there. Gravitons. Okay, Planck mass gravitons. Ooh. Now, I had conversations with Yvette Fuentes, who has ideas about detecting gravitational signals in strange ways using Bose-Einstein condensates. And so we talk a bit about this. And I worry about her machine. If they get hit by a graviton, well, that's an artillery shell. Usually you don't see it. If you detect it, woof, the whole explosion, including the lab all around it, gets blown to smithereens. That's no good. Not much of a physical argument. But it seems to me, for various reasons that I have other reasons, that something of a Planck mass ought to behave pretty well as a classical particle. It tries, this wave function tries to spread, but it keeps collapsing, putting it like that. That's another story. But anyway, so the idea is it behaves pretty classically at that stage. And so the signals it emits are pretty classical. So you would expect these signals, which were pretty well impulsive gravitational signals, collect them together into a galaxy. There will be huge numbers of these coordinates come together in some great mess coming from there. They would also have to have an influence in the succeeding eon. And that's where you would get the, you see, you've got to do the good thing that inflation does, namely give you the scale invariance for the temperature fluctuations. In this model, where that comes from is that the decays of the dark matter particles produce signals which influence the temperature in a scale invariant way and explain why the scale invariance is there, at least up to a good degree, and then you can probably explain why it's not quite scale invariant too. So this is work for the future. Those are ideas which we're playing with, and I think there's a good chance that you would be able to explain the way that the cosmic microwave background has these fluctuations in temperature, which are pretty well scale invariant. I never liked the idea of inflatons fluctuations in the inflaton field, because how do you get quantum fluctuations turned into these huge, great variations in temperature, which you see all over the place? So I found that a little difficult to swallow. But here, these are classical already, because the Erebons, this is the dark matter particles, get decay into classical gravitational signals, which maybe could be seen in LIGO, perhaps, but not the signals that LIGO expects to see. They should be turned out the rubbish bin and have a good scrub through the rubbish bin, see whether they see signals of the right kind here. Thank you very much.
Would you be able to help me with the mic?
Sure.
Okay, there's a tradition of Perimeter with starting with questions from the students. So do we have any questions from the students?
Hello. Do you have estimates of how many Hawking spots you would expect to see in the sky?
Good question. Well, you see, you can calculate how many there should be all over the whole sky. Probably something like 1 million. Now, you see, most of them be pretty faint. It depends on how big the galactic cluster is. The ones that we see, it depends on how far down you go. The five that we see absolutely clearly in both WMAP and Planck would probably be very exceptional ones, which are huge galactic clusters. But most galactic clusters are much smaller than that. So when I say something like 1 million, the vast majority of them will be much fainter than the ones that we seem to see. But yeah, you should see lots of them. Much, much fainter, most of them. But a few prominent ones like the ones we seem to see. We only look at, I think I forget what fraction of the sky is looking at this. I think a bit more than half, I can't remember. let's say half the sky, because the strip from the galaxy is removed. And so at least you see twice that many, but we seem to see it in the Planck analysis about 30 or so. But there should be far, far more, according to the theory, there should be far more, much, much fainter ones.
Yeah, but so you know how many clusters there are of a certain mass, right?
Yes.
So you could calculate how many of a certain signal you would expect.
Half a million, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
No, that's right. I must look at it again, because you have to be a little careful about, you know, how wide the distances you're looking at and so on. My calculation was very rough and hand-waving. I don't think it's far off that. And one can make it more precise, as you say, exactly. One knows how many clusters there are in what we see, and one assumes that it's not that different overall in the ones you don't see. Although there are questions about that too. I should say there are questions, because we see the universe in the other considerations. I don't know about the Hawking point ones, but the other ones with the rings, that you seem to see a very, very inhomogeneous pattern in the universe, which says that the universe is not nearly as completely smooth as we seem to think on the large scale. There are centers of these colliding, apparently colliding black holes within a cluster, which are very much concentrated in certain directions and not spread out over the whole sky in a uniform way. I think very interesting to explore these things.
Thank you.
More student questions?
Could you elaborate a bit more on the initial density fluctuations that lead to the large-scale structure we see in the universe today?
Yes, I should, because I was talking really about the other things. But yes, indeed. let me just talk. I think I won't get you a picture. Yes, the idea is that I call these dark matter particles Erebons, because I thought I needed a name. I needed a nice Greek god or something to name these things after. So I looked up in Wikipedia for a god of darkness, and it said, no, there's no god of darkness. So, but then they said, oh yeah, no, there's an Egyptian god of darkness, and he's called Erebos. So I think that's fine, I'll use it. So I was giving a talk in Vienna about these things. And then I thought I'd better check up, and looked at Google again. And then, no, there's a Greek god, as it changed their minds. He's not a god, I should say. He's a he's not a titan either. I think he's pre-titan. But that's all the better, because he's primordial, you see. So I'm calling these things Erebons. And the Erebon decay rate has to be something like, the half-life is something like 10 to the 11 years. Now you see, you need that. They can't go off too early, or that would spoil the scale invariance. You see, these are the decay of them. The idea is that the Erebons decay into mass, into gravitational wave signals. So you have to imagine a short burst of gravitational wave signal, which is something like a, whether these solutions, what are they called? I've forgotten his name now, where you have an impulsive release of energy out of atmosphere. So that's a good part, first of approximation. But there will be a kind of oscillation to it too. And this will hit the crossover surface and will produce a temperature increase along the direction of the impulse. Now, to get the amount coming out right, it probably, there will be variations in these things, which are to do with the fact that they're randomly going off all over the sky in the previous eon. But also, there's probably a clumping effect due to a sort of Hambury-Brown twist effect, because the gravitons behave as bosons and things like that. So you have to worry about that, and I think that's a crucial factor. I'm just telling you things you need, because I haven't done the calculation, and I don't know how to get 10 to the minus 5. That's the sort of thing. There may be some parameters that we need in the crossover. There's some numbers we have to feed in. But that's a calculation for the future, to see if that really works. But to get scale invariance, that at least is fairly clear. Because if the Erebons of decay is fairly uniform, throughout the universe. And that would be because the dark matter is pretty uniform. The error bonds, as they're created in the equations, from the way the conformal factor works, will be pretty well uniform over the whole universe. And so that will take part in the exponential expansion of the universe, and these will decay, as I say, roughly speaking, one over every 10 to the 11 years. But some of them will go earlier, some go later. And if you look at a region and see how many, you know, you try to look at the scale invariance of the expansion and so on. As long as that scale invariance of the expansion holds, better to say it really is like a de Sitter space, the uniform exponential expansion. And if the decay didn't deplete the particles, then you will see scale invariance in the pattern. So that much we can see from the picture. However, if the mass is depleted because of the lifetime, and that's why I say 10 to the 11 years and not 10 to the million years or something, well, the other reasons too, but 10 to the 11 years means that you will have a slight tailing off because of the depletion of the error bonds in the later part of the time, which means that you will have a tail off in the scale invariant spectrum, so it won't be quite scale invariant. And so the argument is that you will get also a spectral index in accordance with what we see. That's an observational thing which will tell us the lifetime of the error bond. That's a calculation we haven't quite done yet, but I think the observations of the spectral parameter tell us that the lifetime is something like 10 to the 11 years. That needs, again, a calculation which needs to be done properly. I'm just telling you off the top of my head what I think the answer should be, something like that. Okay, that's a rough story. They decay into gravitational signals and they cause the dark matter to ripple, and those ripples will cause the last scattering to have these fluctuations in it. Needs to be done. I'm just saying that's the picture. To make sure that picture does what it should, does it agree with what we see? Yes, an important project.
Thank you for your talk, Professor. So I just wanted to ask, you're committed now to a specific scenario for the end stage of black hole evaporation, right? So something like a long-term stable remnant would be inconsistent with this?
I don't know. I think if there was a remnant, goodness knows what, say a Planck mass remnant, maybe it's an error bond. Planck mass remnant would make almost no difference to the picture. You see, there's this huge amount of energy which comes out, you know, that entire mass of that super-duper massive black hole converted into energy and makes it basically concentrated at that point. If there's a little remnant there, I don't think you see anything. So I can't see that it would affect the picture. If it's a small remnant, which occurs only, say, at a Planck scale at the end, yes.
Thank
Even
you.
If it's a solar mass remnant, I don't think it would make any difference, because you're looking at something ridiculously tiny by comparison with the huge amount of energy which is released in the entire history of that supermassive black hole. But it's an interesting question to consider. But I think remnants don't. I think if you say there's some other theory that black holes don't radiate, or there's a firewall, or goodness knows what, I mean, any of those things might spoil the picture completely. But I don't think a remnant does much to it.
I think we have time for one more question.
Yeah.
Deeper, okay.
Hi. So I haven't studied the paper analyzing the Hawking spots in detail, but I would offer a personal anecdote as someone who's also looked for spots. For a while I was obsessed with the idea that we could verify the idea of eternal inflation for looking for the signatures of collisions between bubble universes in the CMB sky.
Sure, yeah.
And I was just looking at one of our old papers, and I want to make the following distinction between local goodness of fit for a particular part of the sky to a particular model you might have interest in, and a global assessment of how likely we expect that theory to explain the full sky CMB data. So I could tell you that we found 10 spots on the sky that had greater than 4 sigma significance, according to some statistic that we came up with, which I imagine is, you know, maybe the analog of what you guys had done. And that, you know, roughly translates then into, you know, 1 in 1,000. So if you do 1,000 simulations, it would be odd to find one simulation that had a similar spot of, of, you know, that significance. But nevertheless, if you take into account the fact that those spots could have been centered anywhere on the sky, the fact that they could come in a variety of sizes, the fact that they could come in a variety of amplitudes, then that dilutes the global statistical significance to a point that when I take those factors into account, which you could sort of lump into the quote, look elsewhere effect, that the global significance is actually not that big. So I just wanted to offer that personal anecdote that there is quite a big difference between a global significance and a goodness of fit to a particular statistic in localized regions of the sky.
Of course, I'd have to see the details of that. I don't think, I mean, certainly I've had people complaining, you know, about the look elsewhere effect and so on, which has a certain grain of truth in it, in that initially they were looking for not that signal, they were looking for rings, and that's where you found this signal. But I don't think you can dilute it by that much. I mean, okay, the first, when we had the first 10,000, sorry, 1,000 simulations, then there were some complaints, maybe a look elsewhere effect would reduce the probability of something not too surprising. But then the next 9,000 on top of that confirmed exactly the same phases we had before. Seems to me that that kind of argument, I would have to know exactly the kind of thing you're saying here, but I don't see any chance of it being something like that. But I could be wrong, of course. And I mean, that's what we're looking at. We're looking at the whole sky. Well, we're not looking at the whole sky. We look at the sky apart from the galactic strip across the middle. But that's at least half the sky. I can't remember exactly. It's something like that. So we're looking at about half the sky. And sure, we see what we see, but that's part of the statistic. I don't think see why I should divide that by something, because we don't know where the spots are. But that's the way the analysis is done. The analysis is done without any prejudice as to where the spots are. Don't know if it answers your question, because I just find it would find it very surprising if somehow. I'm not sure how would one falsify it. How were your spots falsified?
Well, so you know, you can identify these interesting places, and there's a local significance.
Yes.
But then you can try and turn those local significances into a global statement about how much better of a fit is my model with spots to the data than the model without those spots. Yeah, and it's just not terribly more significant to add those spots, given the fact that you've got all these extra free parameters now in your model. So you always pay a penalty for having a more complicated model in trying to assess, you know, in trying to do a model selection problem.
I don't think there's parameters like that here. I mean, let me say something else, which is more for the future than really answering this. You see, there are several other things you ought to see at Hawking spots. One of them would be rings. You see, if you see actually the endpoint of a supermassive black hole, which used to be in a big cluster, then that black hole would have had many, many collisions with others before it formed, ended up by being the one that's left over. And so there should have been these earlier events, the rings. Now, by virtue of the very fact that you see them, the Hawking points, well, I don't know if I expressed the geometry well, because you see them, you're seeing the endpoint, you don't see the rings through raised or through lower temperature, because you only see them edge on. And if you see them edge on, then the analysis that was done by the poles would not see them, because they look for warmer or cooler temperatures, or raised or lower temperatures, which it was. But if you use the analysis that Vahe Gurzajan did, my Armenian colleague, and he looked for low variance, and in the low variance rings, you should see them. there would be low variance and average temperature. So in the color coding, usually the green is sort of in the middle. So my colleague Tristan Needham said we should call these things Goldilocks rings because they're not too hot, not too cold. So I thought that's a nice terminology. So the each one of these Hawking points ought to be surrounded by Goldilocks rings. Now that's a prediction. They may be very faint. And I got Vahe to have a look and see if he could see Goldilocks rings with these. It looked as though there were about three, but it wasn't very persuasive. So that's, we need to look more clearly. That's one thing. Thing number two you might see, clusters of galaxies should be accompanied by magnetic fields. Now, magnetic fields being electromagnetism should get through. And so you should see primordial magnetic fields at the Hawking points. Now it's curious that, now you see this is the Bicep 2 people, at one point thought they saw B modes in the polarization in the light, and then it was sort of, people said, no, that's effective dust or something. But it's quite curious that at the point that they were looking, Bicep 2 point, there is a triple of Goldilocks rings. And there also is, I haven't checked to see if it's the same place, but there also is a Hawking point there. So, okay, this needs further examination. Is it sure coincidence? Is it that close? Maybe we're points which aren't close enough to consider, and so on. I think we have to look carefully at that. But at least I'm saying that for further looking, as you were saying, you look for other features of the signal. Here are other features that one would expect to see along with Hawking points. You'd expect to see Goldilocks rings, you would expect to see primordial magnetic fields. So that's an interesting, I mean, I'm suggesting that maybe the Bicep 2 observations were not necessarily dust, but possibly primordial magnetic fields, which would cause B-modes. So that's another possibility. People should go and look.
Great, thanks.
So we're under a bit of time pressure because the AV staff have to set up this room for the public lecture tonight, but they assured me that they'll kick us out if we go too long. So I did notice that Kendrick had his hand up.
Hi, so what I'm going to say is pretty correlated with what Matt said, but I'll say it anyway, that I would put this in the same category as other large-scale CMB anomalies, like the dipole power asymmetry or the CMB cold spot. And the issue is always that the look elsewhere effect makes assessing statistical significance kind of subtle. So here your statistic has at least two parameters. There's an inner radius and an outer radius.
Yes.
And then in addition, from reading the paper, I noticed that the tail statistic that you use for the CDFs has a free parameter in it as well. There's also a discrete parameter, since you can look for hot spots or cold spots. And so
these are, you're looking at the gradient of the temperature, and it's got to go one way. So there's no question there. It's got to be hotter in the middle. Hot or cold for the ring. The rings that we claim come from the black hole collisions, the gravitational waves, those could be hot or cold, depending upon whether they're far or close. But the Hawking points would all be warmer in the middle and cooler on the outside. That's what we see. None of the other way around. That's not quite true. You see one or two the other way around. But they're when they get bigger enough, and that may well be the other effect, yes.
My point is that when you estimate statistical significance, your statistic depends on several parameters that you fix to the values where the data is the most anomalous. And so when you quote a statistic like a significance like 99.9%, that's not accounting for that's the probability that a simulation is as anomalous as the data at that particular set of values, but it doesn't account for the fact that the simulation had many chances to be anomalous at a variety of values of the parameters. It's like saying my car's license plate is 99.9% anomalous, because what are the odds that a random license plate would end in 943? I chose that value based on knowing what my car's license plate ends in. So it's not really something you should take at face value. And you can account for it in the analysis. You just have to do the same scan over parameters on a per simulation basis that you did on the data. That's the thing that is missing that makes this hard to interpret.
That was the big picture you saw on the scales. There are lots of different R1s and not different epsilons. And you just see zeros in these spots. All the numbers are much, much bigger. So I'm not quite sure if that's what you've said. I didn't quite get your point. I didn't fully hear what you're saying. I apologize.
Well, we have a chance to ask Roger some more questions over snacks in the first floor bistro after this talk.
Yeah,
so I'll suggest we do that. And before we thank Roger one more time, let me just mention that he's agreed to be part of our 3.14 series. So that's happening tomorrow night in the second floor bistro. You can RSVP to Dan Lynch if you want to have dinner there. That happens from 5:30 to 7. And then there's a discussion with Roger starting at 7. So let's thank him again for his talk today.